OneDrive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Well, Chile has just elected its most openly far-right president since the end of the Pinochet dictatorship. José Antonio Kast won the December 14th runoff by a commanding margin, a stunning reversal in a country that just a few years ago experienced a massive social uprising and elected the young leftist government under Gabriel Boric, promising to bury neoliberalism once and for all. How did Chile move so quickly from the estallido social, or the social movement, to the return of the hard right? Was this a vote for authoritarianism or a vote against insecurity, inflation, and political stalemate? And what does Kast's victory tell us about the global resurgence of the far right from Latin America to Europe and the United States? Today, we look at Chile's election from two complementary angles. We first speak with Oscar Mendoza, who offers a clear-sighted analysis of the electoral shift itself, the collapse of the constitutional project, the decisive role of mandatory voting, and the limits Kast will likely face in actually governing. Pablo Abufom in Chile then joins us to situate the significance of Kast's victory in an historical and international perspective, that of the reemergence of Pinochetismo through democratic means, looking at the central role of anti-communism and the kind of authoritarian restoration now taking shape, and what kind of political moment we're entering. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to the show. I'm very pleased to have Oscar Mendoza back with us. He's written a detailed analysis of Chile's election and the political conditions that produced José Antonio Kast's victory. That analysis will appear in the next issue of Against the Current and may well be online now. Rather than treating this result as an abrupt ideological lurch to the far right, Oscar looks closely at the mechanics of the election itself, the failure of the constitutional process, the impact of mandatory voting, the media-driven obsession with crime and immigration, and the institutional limits that Kast will face once in office. His analysis helps us understand how this outcome became possible and why it may be far more unstable than the elections and the headlines suggest. So, Oscar, let me properly introduce you to our audience. Oscar Mendoza Causa is a social scientist who specialized in international development and has traveled extensively in the Americas, Africa, and Asia. He arrived in Scotland as a political refugee from Pinochet's dictatorship and has worked ever since in solidarity with Chile to preserve the memory of Chile's popular unity government and to mobilize against the dictatorship by writing sharp analyses of Chilean politics in articles and in talks and so much more. And Oscar, I'm really thrilled to have you back with us today. And I should say that you're not a stranger to these airwaves.
No. Thank you, Susie. As ever, I'm very pleased to be able to contribute to listeners' thoughts and ideas, because it must be pretty shocking to hear how did we go from a young, charismatic, left-wing progressive president to this very, very boring far-right extremist. It's really surprising, unless you look at the detail and then you understand how we came.
That's exactly where I wanted to begin, Oscar, and I'm glad you did that, because I was going to say it's just 6 years ago, which just seems like a lifetime in some ways because of the pandemic, but that Chile experienced this massive social rebellion or civic rebellion, whatever you want to call it, that was all also not just Chilean. It was part of a worldwide anti-austerity social movement, you could say. But in Chile, it brought 1.2 million people out into the streets in just one day in a country which is 15 million. And I'll have you give us the results of the actual election, you know, the scale of the victory of the extremist right-wing president, whose father was a Nazi and whose brother was a minister in the Pinochet dictatorship. So let's just go. So how did we go from the Estadio and Borch's victory to a far-right president in 4 years? What are the turning points that you can go through?
I think we should look at it firstly in terms of the Boric government and its failings. As you said, there was enthusiasm for this new president, represented a new political movement also. The well-established coordination of parties for democracy that was in power for the very big chunk of the post-dictatorship. And there was this young guy.
34 years old, right?
Well, the time Boric was 35, 36 when he took power. But yeah, incredibly young. But also charismatic figure, very warm, very close to people and so on. So what happened? What did go wrong? And really, if you look at the period from March 22 till now, there is a litany of events that meant that by the time this election took place, there was a very strong anti-governmental feeling. And the approval ratings of Boric at best reached 32-33%. I'm talking towards the end, you know, when we came to the election. Okay. At the beginning, he was more popular than that. So the government started really badly in the early days with the failed visit by the Minister of the Interior, the highly popular Luis Casiches, who had been the campaign chief for Boric, decided to visit one of the indigenous Mapuche communities in the south. They had been in rebellion against the Chilean state. And for whatever reason, she went with a small group of people, thinking that indigenous Mapuches would welcome her with open arms. Instead, she was repelled with bullets, as in the indigenous community of Temucuicui came out and they started firing at the official delegation. So they had to retreat in absolute panic and so on. And this caused, you can imagine in Chile, Chile is a rather conservative place, you know. So for an interior minister to be repelled by an armed group is just completely out of the normal bounds. So that was the start. That was all in March. Then we had Boric, understandably so, coming out in full support of the draft constitution, you know, that the convention was putting together. And let's remember very briefly, convention came about because of the estallido social, the uprising, the revolt, although the revolt was completely peaceful by and large, you know, with small, very small amount of disturbances and violence, which the right used forever and ever, and they still talk about. And so the convention, unfortunately, was a feast of wishful thinking, so that the proposal was very soundly defeated in September of 22. So within the first few months of Boric's government, there was already two big things that had happened.
We should just very quickly say that the Constitutional Convention was in every way unorthodox and brought in sectors of the population who had no political experience and lots of different political pet projects and did not really do outreach and argued among themselves. And the whole thing was televised and the right had a heyday with it in denouncing this new constitution that offered a bunch of stuff. But in the end was very, very radical, just out of touch, I'd say.
Yeah, it didn't really speak to the immense majority of the Chilean population. And one of the duties of a politician is to lead, yes, but also to listen and interpret, you know, the feeling of people. Here, you know, they ignored it completely. And the defeat of the constitutional proposal was dramatic. We're talking about 68% of the voters with an 85% turnout, which was huge, were against it. And only 32%, which if you look at it, is roughly the level of Boric's approval. So let's move on very quickly. Early 2023, in March, the tax reform proposals from the Boric government are soundly defeated in Congress. So another plank of the government, because we need more revenues in order to deliver all the, you know, the programs and the social needs in terms of pensions, education, health, and so on. Then, you know, quickly following up in the same year, the case exploded in June 2023, when not-for-profit foundations associated with Borges' broad front, you know, the Frente Amplio, today it was then different constituent parts, were involved in a fraud. As in, they were putting projects, getting significant funding from the state, and then, you know, these funds were not utilized for the purposes, but rather for political activity or whatever. The case is still in the courts, but we're talking about, at the moment, the Fiscalía, the prosecuting arm, talks about $95 million being involved in different fraud cases.
We should probably just note as well that all of the press in Chile is right-wing, dominated by the right.
The immense majority, yeah, absolutely.
Right. So they, of course, didn't stop attacking Borges for all of this. And probably, I don't know, because you read it far more closely than I do, did not talk about the successes that they did get in terms of what?
Absolutely not. Borges' government had and will be able to show some achievements, but they were completely overshadowed by the scandals, by the failings, and also by the issues of irregular immigration and violent crime, which is in the newspapers, on TV, on the radio, every single day of the year in Chile. Those are the two topics that occupy every inch of public space.
Even so much that, you know, Chilean friends of mine who are visiting Chile this, you know, are very worried that if they are in downtown Santiago, will they be robbed? Will they be witness to murders? And, you know, the propaganda is broad and wide.
Absolutely. Although crime and violent crime in Chile has been growing significantly from being a really peaceful society with the introduction of organized criminal gangs, you know, from Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, and so on. This has become a much more difficult situation. But that talks about the government's failings. It's also important to know what Cass got right. What did he do that led him to the presidency, you know, to be our president-elect?
But Boric would not have been able to stand for re-election. So talk a little bit about the candidate who emerged from the left and what chances she had against the right in all of its candidates.
Sure. Well, Jeanette Jara, working class woman, Communist Party member, if you look at it, she was, in my opinion, a stunningly good candidate. She did really well. She's a very warm, charismatic woman. She did her absolute best. To me, the fact that a communist working class woman achieved 42% of the vote, you know, with a turnout of over 85% and got over 5 million votes is truly stunning. I would never have imagined it. So I don't think Jeanette Jara had much to do with this result. She was an excellent minister during the time she was in the government, but she had to carry the weight that she was seen as a continuity candidate. And whoever would have been the official candidate, from the parties who are in government today, would have lost, irrespective of who the candidate would have been. It was clear from some time ago that the opposition would win the election. What wasn't clear, because everyone assumed that it would be the candidate of the more traditional right, Evelyn Matthei, you know.
From UDI.
Who would win hands down. I mean, it was, you know, 18 months ago, something like that. Everything said, next president of Chile will be Evelyn Matthei.
And can you situate Matthei in the right-wing political spectrum with Kast and then, was it Kaiser?
Yeah. Well, comes from exactly the same source as both Kast and Kaiser. Kast was a member of the, you know, Unión Democrática Independiente, the UDI, UDI in Chile, the same as Matthei all those years. He represented them in parliament and so on. So she's the daughter of a member of the junta during, you know, the Pinochet years, and she's a very outspoken right-wing person. And she's never distance herself from Pinochet years and so on. So the difference are there and they're clear, but they're not that huge. Although from what I could see in her statements, she is not convinced that Cass is going to do well in government. You can tell, you know, you can see she's saying, well, you know, the president-elect has made a lot of promises. Let's see.
That's right. And we should say he won with 58% of the vote because he managed to get the right-wing vote in total, it looks like, or almost.
Well, that's what I wanted to say in terms of the things that Cass got right. The first thing he got right was his decision not to compete in a primary of the right-wing forces. He refused to contemplate going to a primary with Mattei and whoever else. He said, nah, we're going independently and we'll go to the first round. And that proved absolutely brilliant, because then Mattei started going down in the polls. She started making mistakes, you know, because 18 months ago, as I said, Evelyn Mattei couldn't lose, but she lost very badly. The second thing that he did was that he positioned himself as the leader of the anti-Boric forces. He positioned himself as, I represent this huge majority of the country that is not happy with the Boris government because of crime, because of immigration, because of this. It doesn't matter. Because, you know, in modern politics, facts do not matter. You can say, you know, but look at the economy. You know, because right. Chile is actually growing, inflation is low. You know, there are lots of good things. But no. Chile is absolutely terrible. You know, everything is wrong. And I used to say to my wife in conversation, every single thing that happens in Chile is Borges' fault. You know, it rained too much in the summer. Well, it must be Borges. So,
right.
But he did that. He did really well. So voters wanted an alternative when we cast in very large numbers.
And it didn't seem to matter, or people didn't pay attention to, say, Cast's actual politics, or they just paid attention to how he positioned himself in this election?
Absolutely, because Cast was very, very able in avoiding completely the culture wars and not ever mentioning his extreme right-wing views. So, for instance, on women, on abortion, sexual minorities, indigenous
people. That's where he's horrific.
Work is right. He said nothing, not a word. He only spoke about focusing on Boric's Achilles heel, in a sense, you know, irregular immigration, crime and violence, and the economy. Although, as I said, the economy is actually performing better than expected. And the Boric government has done very well, considering what he inherited from Piñera, you know, in 2022. With very high inflation, very low growth, and loads of issues. And he's done very well, but people don't listen to facts. I mean, you have the example of the US.
I was going to say the same thing. I think Ariel Dorfman called it the feeling of malestar, of malaise, or things aren't going well. And you can do the same thing here. Biden used to run on policy and the economy's doing well, but that's not how people felt.
Absolutely not. They were convinced that the economy was terrible. Even though if you look at the facts, if you look at the data, the economy in the last year of Joe Biden's government was doing pretty well. And if you compare with the initial period of Trump's second term, you know, it was doing great. So anyway.
Yeah. So right. So the same thing internationally, we can say. People vote their gut.
Absolutely.
So I was going to ask you, too, if, you know, we talked about how decisive compulsory voting was, and you're talking about Cass' program. So maybe we should talk about who these voters are who voted for him and what message they took away from his campaign.
Sure. Well, I mean, firstly, we must say that, you know, the Chilean right wing, saying people who will always support the right wing candidate, are a little over a third of Chilean voters. You know, in my opinion, that they never reach even 40%. When the right-wing candidates like Piñera went over the 40% mark, it was attracting center voters that would go with the right-wing because of the program or because they were discontent with the previous government or whatever. These voters are mostly lower middle class. They are uninterested in politics. They are not engaged, not involved, and they don't care. And they have total mistrust of political parties and political figures. But they are very keen to progress. They want, they're aspirational. A lot of them are kind of younger men under the age of 50 and so on. And when forced to vote, they go against the unpopular government. And the alternative was Castle, their vote.
For example, said, I think in the last time we spoke that they kind of put the middle finger to everybody and everything, right? And just said, no, that was in terms of the Constitution. Sure. People who were forced to vote and didn't really want to, low information voters, as we call them.
Oh, no, absolutely. But it's also this issue of politics, of feelings and emotions. How do you feel about the government? Doesn't really matter that the government actually approved the pension reform that is benefiting over a million pensioners now in the first few days of January. It's already benefited some, but it's going to benefit even more. That is passed the reduction of the working week to 40 hours, although it's been implemented gradually, and Cass would probably try to put a stop to it, and so on. The government has actually achieved in certain ways, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. All they see is the scandals in terms of the vice minister accused of rape, the not-for-profits that committed fraud, et cetera, et cetera.
Really interesting that you said that there's about 30, a third of the country that's actually right-wing, and that's been consistent for a very, very long time.
For a very long time. Absolutely.
Yeah, but, and in this case, Cass decided not to play to his base, to them, but to the middle, right? Is that sort of what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that Cass understood from the defeat of the right-wing constitutional proposal that if he insisted on the culture wars and all those kind of extreme views, the center would not necessarily follow him, even if they were against the current government and whoever was representing the current government. But the issue we're faced with now, of course, is that we don't really know what the Cass government will do because they avoided telling us what they would do. And they made, lots of promises that most analysts see as completely undeliverable, the cut in fiscal spending of $6,000 million within 18 months. And that's about 6% of the annual, budget of the country, of the current annual budget. And he never explained how. And people, now they're going to say, okay, let's see how you cut the budget. He said he would get rid of 330,000 irregular immigrants during his period of government.
He also said he's going to build a wall, and you've already described the mountains, that separate Chile from...
It's not so much. I mean, he might be able to build a wall. How long will that take? And also, how difficult is it for somebody who really wants to get over a wall to do it, Anyway.
Right.
Has he not heard of tunnels? You should go to Tijuana.
Well, let's move then to in your article, Oscar Mendoza, and that article is going to be in Against the Current. You talk about the difficulties that Cast would have in implementing his program in any case. So can you just tell our listeners, first of all, the structure of the parliament and the Senate and, how that, it's not like here, but it's still going to represent some sort of obstacle.
Sure. Yeah? But it's actually quite similar, our presidential system with the executive branch, and then you have Congress that has also got a Senate. Funnily enough, there are 50 senators.
So it's very similar.
and we have the lower house of deputies, it's about 155 or something like that. But what happened that in the senatorial elections and lower chamber elections that took place at the same time as the first round, basically the situation within Congress, both the Senate and the lower chamber, is that there will have to be political deals. And you can only do political deals when both sides agree. So the Cass more radical measures have very little chance of actually becoming legislation. It's highly unlikely because they'll have the total opposition forces that they will be by then you know, the Broad Front, the Boris's Broad Front, the communists, the socialists, and so they will all be against it. And then the People's Party plays a fundamental role, because the People's Party, that is a populist, kind of liberal, but not typical force, they will have 14 of the deputies, and their votes will be absolutely essential for moving things along. Some analysts are contending that if the Kast government goes badly, which is a possibility, the second round of the next presidential elections in 2029 would be between Parisi and Boric.
Wow.
Because the assumption, is that Boric will lead the Broad Front to the next elections as well. And if you think about Boric's popularity now, which is about 32%, that's a very strong base to start the campaign on. I mean, you already have almost a third of the country behind it, you know.
So this is a very good place to kind of think about wrapping up Oscar Mendoza, but also talking about, well, what about the left now? That's something that you're concerned with. There's been in some articles that are doing kind of an inward look. What did we do wrong? How do you see that in this next period?
Well, you know, some of the more reasonable on the left suggest the left has to go and do the traverse through the desert, you know. I said the left has been doing badly in many senses for some time now. This is not recent. I mean, some on the left, for instance, the Communist Party, the more Stalinist part of the Chilean Communist Party, is blaming Boric. Other people are saying, no, it's because Janet Jara was a communist. No, the issues here, it's the same for the left everywhere. We don't have a plan. We don't have a vision, something to offer the people that they will say, yeah, that's what I want. That's the kind of society I want to live in. And we've been driven by the division in identity politics. And, oh, we're feminists. Oh, no, we're pro-indigenous. We're multicultural. We're, you know, whatever. And we ran away from the working classes that were the support of the Chilean left for 100 years, you know. So we need to get back to that. Let's represent the people that we say we represent. Because at the moment, we don't represent anybody.
Right. And this is also an international issue. Of course, we've just had this spectacular victory in New York. Mamdani, who ran on one focus, affordability.
Affordability.
And that
absolutely
resonated.
Yeah. If somebody on the left in Chile had run on crime and violence, irregular immigration, getting more money in your pockets, you know, they would have had a good chance.
So I guess finally, Oscar Mendoza, after this overview and analysis of what happened and what went wrong, how do you see this next period ahead? Is it going to be very difficult? Is it going to be a stasis? Do you have any thoughts?
I think people who are on the one hand saying, oh, it'll be terrible, we should all be terrified, you know, this son of a Nazi party member, because I'm not talking about a Nazi supporter, you know, a car-carrying German National Socialist Party member who has extreme views in a range of subjects, particularly social, moral, and to do with working people. He's the president. But Chile functions. Chile has institutions. It has an independent judiciary. It has a Congress. You know, it has movements. It has political parties. It has intellectuals. Chilean professionals are recognized across the world. We are highly educated, very able people. Chile will function. I'm actually much more, not happy with the result in any way, of course. I'm disgusted in some ways. But I'm comfortable with seeing what happens. Let's see what happens. I always go back to my political leader and visionary, Salvador Allende. And I have faith in Chile. You know?
It's a wonderful place to end it. And I can't thank you enough for your analysis, Oscar. And of course, we'll be inviting you back as this new government continues.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens to the new government. And I'll be delighted to come and chat to you again, Susie. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Oscar Mendoza, social scientist, political analyst, and always has the most wide-ranging and interesting and sharp, astute look at Chilean politics. Thanks for joining us today on the show, Oscar. Welcome back to the show. I'm Susie Wiseman. We're going to continue our look at the election results in Chile that saw the far-right Antonio Kast win by a very large margin in the December 14th second round of Chile's presidential election. And now we're going to be looking also at its historical meaning and what it portends. Pablo Abufom is here with us. He's going to situate the significance of Kast's victory in an international and historical perspective, that of the reemergence of Pinochetismo through democratic means, looking at the central role of anti-communism and the kind of authoritarian restoration that's now taking shape or that will be taking shape, and what kind of political moment we're entering. Pablo's the co-author of a major analysis in Jacobin America Latina that argues that José Antonio Kast's victory represents something unprecedented in Chilean history, the first democratic government of Pinochetismo. And rather than seeing Kast as an aberration or a protest candidate, Pablo situates his rise within a long tradition of authoritarian neoliberalism, anti-communism, and moral conservatism, now all put back together within a global far-right moment. And this conversation begs the question, what kind of a regime project is emerging in Chile, and what kind of opposition will be required to confront it? So Pablo, with all that, welcome back to the show. Let me properly introduce you. Pablo Abufom is a philosopher, translator, collaborator with the Spanish language edition of Jacobin magazine. He's a member of the political group Movimiento Solidaridad, that's Solidarity Movement, and a spokesperson for the Coordinadora por Palestina, a coalition of social movements against genocide and the occupation of Palestine. Pablo, I'm very happy to have you back. I guess I could say condolences on the results of this election, especially the margin of defeat and what it means. But let's just talk about it. This time we're seeing the return of Pinochet through the ballot box, or are we? You're arguing that this is the first democratic government of Pinochetismo. So what does it mean?
Hey, Susie, it's great to be here. It's sad that it's in these circumstances, but it's great to discuss Chile again. It's important to realize that the whole idea of Pinochet as a political figure and a movement around him is something that took shape during the 80s. So already in the second decade of his dictatorship, when some of the consequences of the changes that were implemented by the dictatorship, both in social, economic, political aspects, but more pointedly, the economic challenges that Chile was undergoing those days, early 80s, I'm talking about. This is when the whole idea of washing the face of this authoritarian regime led by a military was necessary for the right wing in Chile. They needed to redo the image of Pinochet. And so by the mid-80s, they had already created political movements and a political space to turn the image of Augusto Pinochet into something that would be more respectable within the democratic order that was normal in Latin America by the time. The Argentinian dictatorship had ended in 86. By 87, Pinochet was the only dictator left in South America. So at that moment, in the 80s, some members of the most conservative sectors of Catholicism and the right wing in the political sense, and who were previous members of the National Party, who was the conservative party, that was the conservative party in the 60s against Allende and the left, and also the neoliberal wing of the economists of the dictatorship, the Chicago Boys, some of them, they all joined ranks and created a political party that was called Unión Demócrata Independiente, Independent Democratic Union, which was meant to be the political base for Pinochet. José Antonio Kast, the president-elect, he was a member of that political party, UDI, for almost his entire life. Actually, his brother, Miguel Cast, was one of the founding members of UDI, together with Jaime Guzmán, who is a very renowned person in the right wing in the history of Chile, because he was the writer of the 1980 constitution that we still have.
And also the mentor of José Antonio Cast, right?
And many, yeah. And many in the right. And this was a new kind of political right formation that saw that they needed to, in a way, they needed to root themselves in the population. They combined their political project and this whole institutional framework of being part of the government, ministries, and then after that, being a political party and being in Congress when the dictatorship ended. They knew that they had to combine that with social action, basically in the territory of daily life. And so in a way, they also claimed the history of a sector of the right wing in Chile of Catholic action in the popular movements, right? So before the Christian Democrats were born, who were basically born against the rise of communism and the revolutionary left in Chile, it was the Catholic groups that did that kind of work, to go into the poor neighborhoods and sort of like trying to guide the people towards more conservative views. So that's part of the history that Cast can be understood in. And that's very relevant because I think that Cast is the continuation of that project, of a project that is deeply and intimately committed to the project of the dictatorship, of that worldview that it's still a Cold War view in the international arena. It's a strictly neoliberal view in economics, maybe adding this element of the new far right around the world, that it's some kind of fascist sovereignty and the idea that maybe closing some parts of the border, of the economic borders, is not a bad idea, right? Putting our citizens first in a way means or involves some kind of privileging local industry or something like that. But it's a tension, you know? You can see the tension between extremely neoliberal policies and the idea that we need to protect the Chilean economy. Cast is the first president after the dictatorship that has said that he voted for the continuation of the dictatorship. He voted yes on the referendum in 1988. And it's just, you know, a vote on the referendum, but it says a lot about where Chile is regarding its own history, recent history, right? So it appears that the deep political crisis, the deep economic crisis that we're experiencing, the cost of living and unemployment in Chile going up, the whole transformation of society that comes with the huge waves of migration from South America and the Caribbean, of course, it's a huge cultural transformation. It doesn't have to be the way they portrayed it as a prime crisis, you know? And in this sense, Cast and others in the far right, they resemble Trump talking about people coming into our country to, you know, rape people and bring violence and drugs, etc. So Piñera represented a sector of the right in Chile that by the mid-2000s, they sort of disavowed their own relationship with the dictatorship. There's a strict connection between the rise of Cast and governments such as Piñera's government, because Cast actually left his own party, the party that he had been a member his entire life. He left his party precisely because this new right, supposedly more towards the center, were not supporting the military that had been judged and sentenced for human rights violations, that didn't reclaim the legacy of the dictatorship, that had abandoned the ultra-conservative values of their Catholicism. And so Cast is an expression of that change within the right in Chile. In that sense, Cast represents sort of like the comeback of that right. A lot of people left those parties and they created a new space for the right. So it means, just to finish, it means that Pinochetismo as a movement and as an idea that is deeply rooted in some sectors of society still today, they were ashamed of being openly Pinochetistas for a long time, but right. Now they're not ashamed anymore. And CAS represents that coming out of the closet of Pinochetismo.
So interesting. I wonder, in that context, did the fact that Jeanette Jara, a member of the Communist Party, even though, as Oscar Mendoza said in our first segment, that was well-liked and very good minister, but the fact that she was a communist, did that play into the sort of anti-communist sentiment that existed in Chile, and especially that Pinochet used, saying we have to get rid of the communist cancer? And, you know, that was the reason he said that so many people had to be repressed. So how did CAST use that, and how did it resonate?
Anti-communism has been a long tradition in Chile that goes it goes beyond and before the dictatorship. But there's two sides to it. One is actual opposition to the existence of the Communist Party in Chile. And that's one kind of people, maybe the more ideological, the more politicized, the people who are involved in thinking the world in terms of political parties and all that. But then there's this other type of anti-communism that is not entirely related to the Communist Party, but the basic idea of communism and socialism. And for them, communism is not the Communist Party of Chile only. It's the Soviet Union, it's Cuba, it's Venezuela, it's the boogeyman that the right wing has used throughout the entire world.
I want us to move, Pablo, now, because what we've just seen now, we're just 1 week since the election as we broadcast this. And there was a clip yesterday that CAST met with Bachelet, I think, in his election night speech. He tried to speak somewhat moderately. How do you read that? Do you think that means that he's going to try to appear more moderate, or this is just, you know, in the post-election period and then he'll govern, you know, from the far right as he said he would?
It's interesting. I think in some part it means that he needs the traditional right on his side. He cannot be the neo-Nazi that he is so openly. And also I think they know that a vote for CAST was not a vote for Pinochetismo, for their extreme views. It was a vote for change. It was a vote rejecting the disappointment of the social democratic governments in Chile. It was a contextual vote in the context of a crisis. It was a vote of a lot of fear and the sentiment of being abandoned by the state. And CAST sort of represented the most extreme and at the same time the most serious response to that, an alternative to that.
So I want to see how in his program, and you say it in your article, Pablo, that this is going to be a vicious anti-labor government. It's going to be one of austerity, fiscal austerity, and one of repression and social control. So, or maybe just, I'd like you to address how you see politically and economically the CAST government and what it means in Chile and how it relates internationally to what's going on.
I do think that it's going to be a regressive government in terms of some of the social programs that had been advanced and defended and funded by the social democratic administrations. Some of them were implemented during the Bachelet government, and some that are very relevant social programs for childcare, and even the tax reform of Bachelet, it was somewhat progressive. It was not what a leftist would want, but it definitely changed the landscape for big landowners and big business people. And so CAST and his team, his economic team, they want to roll back on that. They want tax cuts for the rich. And of course, they want to remove all regulations in terms of labor, environment, etc. This is not unlike what Trump has been doing in the US. And I think it's the trend throughout the world that in a time of profitability crisis for the capitalist class, what they can do is to destroy everything that is stopping them from being even more predators of nature and labor. And so I think that Cast and his team, they do have this view of how the country should work. It's not really sophisticated. We need to give freedom to the corporate Chile to do whatever they want in order to create jobs, as they say, but it's basically do business because they're all crazy with AI and automation and all that. And so it's basically that they are going to represent the wealthy elements of Chilean society so that they can feel safer to invest and get easy money back from those investments without taking care of anything else. Not the nature, not workers, not education, etc. So I think there's just a catch, I think, for them, that it's the Chilean system, the Chilean political system implemented by the 1980 constitution is highly restrictive to more radical change. So I think that we'll see how far they can get by using their own, you know, constitution. But this is what they've been saying in the past days. If you read, you know, between the lines, is that the most relevant moment is the first 100 days. Because they know that they don't have much time to do that. Because people are going to be disappointed. Because they know that. I mean, it's the same as Milei. It's not going to be good for them.
We only have a few minutes left, Pablo, but I'd like to talk to you about how you see, because so Chile's had a gigantic social movement that erupted and that you were very much a part of in 2019 that got curtailed essentially by the pandemic and by inflation and all these other concerns, but also at the way that the right was able to scare the population because of the hordes of immigrants coming in from Venezuela and Haiti and everywhere else. And because crime wave, and this is, you know, proved to be these are the two ingredients that the right have used to scare the population everywhere and to distract them. So you've just laid out what the real program is. But what about this opposition movement? Do you see a resurgence coming now? And it's probably too early to tell, but do you see the response being a more ferocious one against demonstrations that are obviously going to take place?
I think we can expect that to happen because together with political repression and economic, you know, pro-ultra-capitalist policies, the far right, they're also deeply anti-feminist. And so for them, this whole idea of gender ideology, it's the worst thing that can happen. And they will try to dismantle some of the protections and rights that have been provided for the LGBT community and more broadly.
You should probably say something about what Cass's position, his super reactionary Catholic stance is.
Exactly. Completely against abortion. We have a limited, very restricted law for abortion, but he wants to destroy that too. And we have to remind ourselves that Chile only approved a law for divorce like 20 years ago.
Right.
And so this is the same people who voted, you know, against divorce being legal in Chile and who are against laws that regulate child labor. What I mean is that they're so massively brutal and also very open about it, very explicit about it, that it necessarily will result in some kind of mobilization and protest movement against him. And also because the social movements in Chile have a long history of being able to articulate very clear demands that have not been met for 30 years. That's key, I think, that the same grievances and the same demands that sort of articulated the popular revolt of 2019, they have not been solved. And so they are still there waiting to be solved. The problem is that we already had the popular revolt. And it has been told as a wave of explosion of crime and violence and destruction. And so now a lot of the people who were part of that, but then eventually voted for Cast. I mean, if you do the math, some people must have voted for Cast that were part of those protests. now they are not going to join that kind of movement. So I think we're going to go back to a moment where social movements are going to be more restricted to their own demands and their own social sectors. And it's not going to be a massive movement like the one in 2019. But what's going to be massive, it's a disappointment, because things are not going to get better for the majority of the people. I mean, this past 6 years since the Popular Revolt, it reminds us that people change their minds when it comes to voting for different sectors. And so people who are at one point willing to go out and take out to the streets and even like being confronted by the military and the military police, it's the same people who then, some years later, can vote for a fascist. And I think that sometimes we forget that it's the same people who change their minds. And so it's not that people are fascist in themselves when they vote for a fascist. And this is something we haven't talked about. It's the responsibility of the social democratic administrations and the left not being able to offer an alternative. This is for the next time.
This is the key question, and I'm so glad you raised it. The other point of it is that elections have consequences, and we're all living with those consequences because Chile is not alone in this, and that's also very sad. But I remain hopeful that, you know, the kinds of opposition that we will see surging, not just in Chile, but even here in the U.S. and in Argentina and in Russia and everywhere else that is under this thumb or this boot, you can't prevent humans from rising up and trying to realize an economy that serves them and not that they serve the economy. I want to thank you so much, Pablo, but we will have you back as CAST tries to roll out these horrible measures and see what the response will be. And I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Susie, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks. And just let the listeners know that they can actually go to your article, Jacobin America Latina. If they don't read Spanish, you can get an English version of it. And of course, Pablo writes widely, and we're always looking for his articles. And welcome back to the show. And I'm really pleased that Alan Minsky is joining me now. Alan is a former program director here at KPFK, but he's also the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And that's an organization that's needed more than ever right now if the Democrats are ever actually going to be able to breathe, walk, and be in the coming period. But we're also addressing you because it's the same with KPFK and Pacifica Radio. We are in our fall fund drive, and we need to raise money to support the kind of programming that you tune in to hear. So, Alan, welcome to Beneath the Surface.
It is great to be here, Susie Weissman. And of course, I'm here to encourage people to donate, to support this station, support this show. We really, 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 really need shows like this at this moment in our history. And we really need for people to recognize the way that we keep free speech alive is we all participate in supporting it. There's a question of, you know, keeping the appearance of free speech. There's also the necessity of having an outlet where your voice can be heard, where your perspective can be heard. The kind of analysis that you hear on Beneath the Surface is the kind of information that we know the powers that be do not want disseminating across this country. Okay, so we have to keep this going. The reason it is what it is because it's only supported by you, the listener. Very little government money supports KPFK, so that makes it much less vulnerable to NPR, to being shut down.
Right.
And we have no corporate underwriting, okay? Because we know the corporations are either in the pockets of the ascendant fascists in our society, or they are simply not interested in the kind of critique you hear on KPFK and on Beneath the Surface.
You know, we used to have the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but that was cut out a long time ago. And now all of the public radio stations are facing the same kind of cut. So it's a dire moment. So we have to protect this and keep it on the air. And we're asking you to donate today at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, and dig deep into your pockets and help keep this kind of radio on the air. And we have a few thank you gifts. For $65, you can have a mug, you can have a t-shirt, and you can be a proud sponsor of listener-sponsored radio and free speech radio, as we used to say.
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Look, Susie Weissman's Beneath the Surface really digs into the issues that it addresses. It addresses the relationship of capital to political power in the country and around the world. The question of how left formations operate around the world. Then we also have a serious focus on U.S. foreign policy and foreign conflagrations around the world. Obviously, one of the leading shows in the country. And of course, well, this show actually gets repurposed into one of the most popular left podcasts in the country. It only happens because of KPFK, though. That's because this show becomes Jacobin Radio when the content of it is shared with Jacobin Magazine. And so 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But without KPFK, there's no Jacobin Radio.
Right.
And so just as the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, KPFK is the home station. You need to support KPFK in order to keep these things going. See, radio stations and platform media still actually generate a good portion of what you see as digital media. And of course, they also are news gathering institutions, which all the digital media relies upon as well. We need Pacifica Radio going. We need your support to keep it going. And Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman, I know no show in the country that has consistently looked at the macroeconomic realities of American society and the relationship of that reality to political power and democracy. There was simply no show in the world anywhere that saw the 2008-2009 market crash coming. It was almost like Susie was Nostradamus 2-3 years out about the fragility of the American economy and the understanding of the weakness of capital and its incapacity to deliver for the people. And what is an alternative politics that which can deliver for the people is addressed in the most intelligent, with the most depth of any show that I know in all of American media. There's no question why an organization like Jacobin tapped this show to become its signature podcast. So call 818-985-5735 to keep Susie Weissman's Beneath the Surface on the air at KPFK. To keep KPFK on the air.
Well, thanks, Alan, for all of that, but I can't echo it even more. I mean, we do not just international politics, but also labor, because that's the counterweight. And looking at, you know, the militancy of labor in the last period in a lot of depth, but also the obstacles there. And we can't do it anywhere else. Please call in and give your support, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
It is our free speech media. It's the media we need at this dire hour in our history where free speech is under attack like in no time I have ever seen in my life.
No.
And we just need independent media, media that we own, we control, that is our media. And again, you also get the great show Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman every Sunday here on KPFK Radio, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
Alan, thank you so much. And I can't say enough times to the listeners, this is a critical moment. It's a critical moment for the country, for free speech, for democracy, and it's a critical moment for all of the media that you listen to. We need you to really dig deep right now and give as much as you can at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Think of every dollar that you give as a dollar that defends democracy, that defends free speech, and that defends your voice. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you, Alan Minsky. Thanks always for coming in and helping us do this. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Oscar Mendoza and Pablo Abufom. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Ossie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. There's more information on our program and guests on our Facebook page, and you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support. And please honor your pledges at 818-985-5735. And thanks so much. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Weissman. We'll be right back.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.